There's no denying that first impressions count. Our faces define us, and we are defined by them. But in today's world of filters, face masks and veils, it's not always that simple. Faces can be covered, made up, manipulated, discriminated against and judged. And it's this lens through which my next guest comes to her latest work. In A Face, A Visual Odyssey, Jessica Helfand looks at the cultural significance of the face through history in an elaborately illustrated A to Z of the human visage. Jessica Helfand is the co-founder of Design Observer and a senior critic at the Yale School of Art, where she's been for more than a quarter of a century. Welcome, Jessica, to 9 to Noon.
Thank you for having me, Catherine.
When it comes to what you'd expect from a visual narrative about faces, one might conjure up a book about beauty with glamorous images inside, but you take on a much broader range of perspectives, and the cover image and the listed topics give quite a different feel. How did you come at this exploration of the face?
Well, it's a big topic, as you rightly say, and there is really nothing that doesn't have some facial relationship to something. So coming up with an alphabetic taxonomy was one way for me to wrestle the content to the ground. At least it seemed a good idea at the outset. When I got to about letter M, I was ready to put a fork in my eye. It was a bit of an undertaking. But I think what interested me was how much we think we know that we don't know, how much cognitive dissonance, how much we're all prone to bias, how much of that bias is natural and sociological and even genealogical. The cover, which I'm glad you mentioned, is an image by an English artist that looks like a baby, but it's in fact only half a baby. And so it's a baby bifurcated. So split down the middle, the image is flipped, which means that it's perfectly symmetrical, which a face never is. And yet, in my research, I found that across all standards of beauty in all cultures, symmetry is really in the pantheon of what we look for in a face. So that baby, which is the face of promise and the face of that really, you know, brings everybody to some kind of level of interest, because who doesn't love babies, is in fact a little discomfiting because it's a little too perfect. And so you've got this kind of uncanny valley, as well as a picture of what looks like a perfect child.
How important is the face in our immediate judgment of others, let alone the more layered judgment we're going to delve into?
Well, it's very important, and there have been all sorts of studies by people much more intelligent and gifted around subjects like sociology and scientific research than I am. But we make judgments very quickly. It's why we look to movie stars and models. It explains Instagram. It explains why we vote for the political candidates we do. There have been studies on why we smile a certain way, why we pose a certain way, why a wide jaw confers authority, or a wide face might confer less authority. And so there's all sorts of things that have to do in the absolute with how we equate things like authority and judgment and purpose with a face. Beauty is a little bit more subjective than that. But when you really get into it, it's a very slippery slope, and there's all kinds of pernicious things at foot. So for example, the chapter on P is about something called physiognomy. And that's really the art of face reading, which was called in the 20th century a pseudoscience, which is to say that it wasn't a science at all. Yet it was taught in schools, and there were voluminous copies of books that were issued and lectures that were being given where you were meant to look at a certain way the earlobe folded, or an eyebrow, or the way the jawline was lined up. And none of these things, of course, had anything to do with anything, but it had an enormous amount of impact on things like people getting jobs and getting into schools and being able to really find their way in the world. And that's even before you get to questions like race and sexual orientation and gender. And now what we've got, and particularly now that everybody's wearing a face mask, and I've been doing a lot of interviews about what the face is when you can only see half of it. But even before then, there's, of course, headdresses and burqas and hijabs and all kinds of things all over the world that really describe who we are in terms of our nationality, which is about identity. And it doesn't conform to things like what needs to happen at border control. So what I got very interested in as a visual historian was the degree to which we live individually, like Ralph Waldo Emerson wanted us to. We live our lives. We are all creatures of many things. And yet when it comes to being represented across borders and in the world and on identity cards and in books and on family trees, we just become really a function of the metrics that statisticians have told us to describe ourselves by. And that's where it gets really tricky. If you take that to the next level, you get into things like algorithms and algorithmic bias. That led me into robots and why robots have the faces they do. And you can see why I needed 26 chapters.
Why do robots need the faces that they do?
Well, I'm not so sure. And I'm not so sure they should have the faces that they have. There's so much going on in Japan about this. And one of the reasons I'm giving this interview today from Los Angeles before the pandemic, one of the reasons I came out here was to try to pitch Face as a television series. Because so many of these stories really need to be told through the voices and the faces and the people who make them what they are. And in Japan, the technology and the artistry and the interest in things like, literally, there are roboticists who think that you can download a soul, or that you might one day may be able to actually have soulful characteristics you can download to correspond to a face, so that that face can actually engender a reaction in someone who's not a robot. Meanwhile, they're the most advanced country, I think, in the world in terms of robots that greet you at department stores and robots that greet you as sales clerks, which has an enormous impact, as you can imagine, on the economy and jobs. But the far more concerning environment that I got really interested in, and I dare say I am the only MIT press author who's ever written about this, were the faces on sex robots. And who decides what is an alluring face for someone who thinks that a robot is the place to go find that in their lives? Which I guess in a pandemic might have a new meaning. I don't know. I'm not here to comment on that, but I can tell you that it was really interesting when I got to that part of the book.
But it actually is the latest iteration, and we'll go back through the different eras, of exactly the point, this concept of the idea of there being, and often it's perceived a perfect symmetry, or there being an ideal of either beauty or some other kind of allure attached to the face. So what were the roboticists in Japan basing their designs on?
Well, I suspect they were looking very much at a Japanese aesthetic. You know, a small woman with a high-pitched voice and very simple, beautiful haircut. There's links to it. There's certainly references to it in my book. One of the things that interested me, though, as I went through this was why, and they seem so stereotypical. They seem like they are victims of their own bias to assume that that's what everyone wants. And it's not for me to say that they didn't do gallons of research, and maybe that is what everyone in Japan wants. But I went looking, for example, for robots that were doing faces that were not Caucasian. And I found a very interesting company in Scandinavia that was making robotic faces that were African, that were Asian, that had different skin color. But to come back to the sex robots for a minute, you can really dial all the features on a body that you want, and a face is no different. So again, extremely stereotypical, extremely biased. I'd like to think they did their research. And this is where we get into things like, you know, how we determine what the market will bear. It's a very particular market, and I imagine that these roboticists are working with consumers, knowing who that consumer base is. It's not me, obviously. But what's fascinating is it doesn't just stop at that. There's an entire world of, you know, again, a really interesting sub-world of surrogate babies. So women who either can't have babies or for whatever reason want a baby and are willing to pay for a baby, but they don't want a sentient baby, will spend upwards of $10,000 to get what's called a reborn. And these babies come, they ship with hair follicles, they smell like baby powder, they can be taken out to in a pram, and they look like babies. I mean, they hold them, they droop like babies, they have the musculature of a baby. They even have breathing mechanisms in their chests that simulate the illusion of breathing. I mean, it is an unbelievable market unto itself. And there are artists and roboticists and facial experts and algorithm details that lead these people who make these things, which to me are remarkable and science fiction-like, but there is a market for them. And it's just as valid a market, I suppose, as people who think that they can get the face they want on a woman's robotic body to have sex with her. I mean, it's really, it's an unbelievable thing when you think about it, but that's what's happened.
Well, let's go back to the various eras where this similar kind of obsession with the face has had its moments. The first chapter, Anthropometry, if I've said that right, sets the tone with this past fascination for the measurement of people. And I think that, I mean, literally, there are images in your book of all kinds of clamped on kind of measuring devices. I saw just a good old fashioned wooden ruler out at one point. But this was back around the time of the ancient Greeks, I think, where proportion itself was deemed divine, yeah?
Deemed divine, and then again in the Renaissance, that the Brunelleschi dome is nothing if not divine proportions. So we can trace it all through art history, and we can certainly trace it to the history of art in terms of sculpture, and again across generations and across cultures. But where it starts to get pernicious again is in the hands of the eugenicists. So those first few chapters of the book, I'm looking at anthropometry, I'm looking at biometrics, and I'm looking at caricature ABC. I started to think about what it is to measure. So to measure is to quantify something that perhaps is not so easily quantified. I became interested in things like calipers to measure the nose. Now, this has a really interesting chapter component piece in mugshots and atavism and police wanting to capture criminals. And the father of the mugshot was a guy named Alphonse Bertillon. He was French. There's a lot in the book about that. And mugshots are a fascinating thing to look at because you see the front of the face and the side of the face. And all of the metrics that went along with those police reports were done with exquisite, meticulous detail on the assumption that they then knew who the criminals were and they could find them, they could log them, they could capture them, and they would no longer be criminals because they had actually wrestled to the ground that particular measurable thing. Not so easily understood when you look at the Germans measuring the noses of Jews or gypsies or women. And so the idea that the calipers would be held out by a doctor to identify the length of the nose of someone who was thought to be less valuable than someone who was not a Jew, who was white, who was of the Aryan tradition, you know, starts to get really scary. I mean, very quickly gets very scary. And I was able to avail myself of incredible records about the eugenicists, both in the United States and in Europe, incredible things at the Wellcome in London. So, you know, you can a researcher can do a lot online now to find these things. And for me, what's so fascinating is that the social history is not just about what we see now. It's not just about what we see in books. It's very global. We fail to keep the records that we should have kept. Much of this evidence that I found is more white than it should be. It's more Western than it should be. And I felt it very important to tell the stories of people who weren't here to tell the stories for themselves, Native Americans, people of, you know, who were perhaps hiding stories of their families, people of mixed parentage at a time when it wasn't multicultural, wasn't a word. So it became a real deep dive into a lot of different kinds of social history.
How were they hiding?
Well, I think it was, for example, I went through a lot of ID cards, and women would take the name of their husband so they could get his pension, or they would hide behind the middle name of a relative so they wouldn't be seen to have a Jewish last name if the last name that they had might get them in trouble, or they would. So a lot of it wasn't not in the picture, but it was in the reference points around the picture. There's a great history of that, how we actually use the filling out of forms to deviate or in some way mislead or nullify something to protect ourselves. There's a great history to be written about that. I only touch on it very briefly in this book. But I think that it's important to recognize that not everything is, pardon the pun, what we see at face value.
One of the themes that emerges strongly from early on is the tendency to judge and categorize, and you've referred to the eugenics era, but this could also be related, say, to mental illness, for example. The patient, as you put it, is a performance prisoner. What did you learn in this part of the book?
Well, there's I was very interested in mental illness and how it was depicted through portraiture. The famous story of the portraits of women at the Salpêtrière hospital in Paris at the end of the 19th century, where, and much of it has been written about this, about hysteria and how hysteria was documented, and was it hormones, and were they given drugs to perform this way, and how much of it was a kind of highly sexualized, highly feminized art form. The men were doctors. It was very bifurcated socially. But there were other doctors who realized that photographing faces of their patients allowed their patients to see themselves. And that became a therapeutic benefit. They started to understand themselves in terms of the way they positioned themselves, or perhaps given that they were in asylums and in hospitals, could not avail themselves as readily to cosmetic enhancement or looking good or mirrors. And so the camera became a way to adjudicate or amplify in some way their understanding of how they looked. And so it actually became a tool that was not to the detriment of the patient, but was, in a sense, a social tool. At the same time, to come very briefly back to your question a minute ago about measuring, I got interested in the fact that social media is a form of measurement. And our children who are posting pictures of themselves on Instagram, not even our children, but I'm using children because I think they don't realize sometimes what they're doing, as a popularity contest, or the school photo as a way to measure your child year to year, and did they have a funny haircut or did they gain weight. This doctor, again, to come back to the doctor, would use these photographs to show, oh, you look happier today, or don't you look more at peace? And the patients could see themselves, I think, not in an objectified way, but in an objective way, which was extremely beneficial to their well-being.
It might come as a surprise that the manipulation of images using technology is nothing new. It's all the rage now, of course. In the 19th century in France again, there was a neurologist using electrical probes on his subjects to what? Force certain expressions.
Exactly.
So this wasn't computer-based, clearly. It was done in the physical.
And there are photographs, they're in many collections now, it's been widely published. What's fascinating about those photographs is the degree to which you see not only the face of the person who is, you know, grinning in some strange way because he's got an electrical probe on his jaw, but the fact that the camera is pulled back and you can actually see the electrical pulse being applied. So there's so many levels on which this is terrible. One of them being that they were day laborers who were not named. And so to be in a sense, it's like volunteering to be in a clinical study, realizing you're putting your health at risk. Because these were day laborers who didn't have their own means to be able to get the employment that they were due, they were used and abused and manipulated in this terrible way. The person in question who did these photographs was looking at many things. He himself was a neurologist, and I think he even had an idea that artists could avail themselves of these images to know how to paint someone and look at someone who had, you know, a crazy grin, or you wanted to paint a portrait of someone who had a certain expression. The same way artists turn to anatomy books to understand how to paint the arm. The difference here being, of course, that it was a human subject, like a guinea pig or a monkey in a cage, and using an electrical pulse to get an expression. Really just horrifying.
These days it is filters and airbrushing and various software and Instagram by which we do these alterations of our own images, but they are transferring into our physical selves. You write that cosmetic procedures are booming, but for a different reason, with some thanks to the selfie. I think in 2017 there was a 55% increase in nose jobs.
That is correct, and that's in the book. I was shocked too, Catherine, and I think one of the reasons I wrote this book was I'm fascinated with portraiture. I paint portraits in my studio, and my mother collected them. And I have two young adult children, and I watched them grow up with selfie culture in a way that was not quite affecting me, but it was affecting their peer group. And it occurred to me then, as now, I had sort of strange antipathy about what it meant to use the time you had and the device in your pocket to document yourself and to micromanage yourself and to understand that the real estate by which we trade and the currency in which we trade with these images was limitless. And the myopic narcissism, not my own children, of course, actually not my own children at all. They were as outraged as I was because I talked about it all the time. But the degree to which we were spending time thinking about ourselves and not thinking about others, and I was seeing this playing out in the classroom with my graduate students, and seeing the degree to which we were perhaps not thinking about the humility, but thinking about the hubris, that we were thinking about posturing and narcissism and not thinking about service and stewardship. And then all of these things that I think were important as human skills, as life skills, as technology was encroaching, this was like the last holdup, the last bastion of connectedness to us, which is that our faces are the only things that make us who we are completely individually. Even an identical twin is slightly different, has a freckle in a different place. I learned, for example, an identical twin cannot open another identical twin's iPhone with facial recognition until they are, I think, 12 or 13, because the musculature of the face has not yet been set. So all to say that the individuality of personhood made visual is the face. And what do? We take selfies. We become obsessed with selfies. We then want to have our noses fixed, and we compete with ourselves and with each other about something that is fleeting and not as important as we are making it out to be. Obviously, it's important to me. I wrote a book about the subject, but the psychology and the philosophy and the culture and the emerging understanding of what it is to be human in a moment that is so technologically running away with everything but our pulse, I felt it was really something that needed to be examined with ruthless objectivity.
You are already speaking of the future when you talked about the robotics developments in Japan. And, of course, the other side of this, apart from physically replicating or designing your perfect robot for whatever your chosen purpose is the likes of deepfakes, which again is a theft of more than a face, isn't it? It is potentially a theft of a person's identity, in that we may mistake what we are seeing for a belief that this is actually the person we are seeing, whether it's in porn or whether it is in a presidential candidate. At the same time as we might be horrified by it, we're immensely entertained by apps like FaceApp, and we're entertained and kind of drawn to the idea of altering ours and others' imagery and mimicking others. Snapchat, for example.
Right. So there's a performative kind of proxy relationship we have to seeing ourselves. You know, it's like seeing yourself in a funny wig or a funny hat. It seems harmless until it's not. And I think the thing about face swapping that's so fascinating and terrifying is that the technology for doing it is at breakneck speed. It's running ahead of all of us. You can now, excuse me, you can now pick a face out of a crowd. In China, the technology is dazzling. You can see people as they're moving, getting in and out of trains. Of course, now with social distancing, maybe all of that will be harder. But the studies that I saw when I was writing the book were just unimaginable to me, that so much could be detected when something was fuzzy, when something was at a distance, when something was in motion. So yes, you're right to point out that celebrities and pornography and the sort of dimensions by which we can't actually protect ourselves show that identity theft is much more than just stealing your passport or those things are terrifying as well, and your credit information and so forth. But protecting yourself, knowing that you actually have privacy, anyone who's ever spent 1 second online can kiss that goodbye. I mean, that is a fool's errand. Because we know, for example, in the United States, anyone with a driver's license is in an FBI database. They can find you. I mean, they can find you very quickly. So great for crime, wonderful for certain kinds of protection around the globe in terms of things that are quite serious. But if you think that just playing with swapping your face means that you're just playing and looking at how your nose would be prettier, you know, think again. And then the other thing is, of course, this stuff doesn't go away. The whole idea of erasing yourself or scrubbing your identity from the internet, or the right to be forgotten, even people who have died, even closing down someone's Facebook page. I mean, I'm very interested in what happens after we die, the whole idea of being able to protect your digital identity once you're no longer here to protect it. Yet if you're a person of any renown, people want to visit you, and what happens to a picture morgue? I mean, these are fascinating ethical questions about viewership and ownership and access and protection and privacy and publicity that I don't think anyone knows.
Let's finish with masks, because they have always been, and they have been in different eras and again in different cultures, masks and facial coverings. They are not and have not been typical of our Western cultures in recent years, but all of a sudden we're having to think about them. What has been their purpose, culturally or practically, that you touch on in the book?
Well, there's so much in masks. I mean, there are many, many books written just about that question. It's a wonderful question, and I had actually a lot of fun writing that chapter. I looked at theater and the history of theater and the fact that originally when there weren't enough actors, masks were used to change character on stage, and the audience knew that you had just gone from one thing to another just by virtue of the mask you changed. Certainly, they were about changing identity in more less positive ways, I think. They were used for protection. They're used for beauty. They're used in different ways in terms of sportsmanship. I became interested in something called I think it's called a scold's muzzle. There was a period when if your wife, always your wife, if your wife was gossiping in the town square, you could carry her through town holding onto her with this muzzle to tell everybody that you knew that she'd been gossiping. She shouldn't be doing that in public. So, you know, they were gendered. They were used for shame and stigma. They were used for beauty. And of course, now they're used for something that is very much will always become recognizable as a public health venture. It's a public health venture, even when it's a private health nightmare for some people. I mean, it's not been an easy time, and you can't go out on the street anywhere, I think, across the globe now without seeing most people wearing them. There's a big variety of them, and it stands to be asked, I think, whether they're all masks are created equal. Some of them look quite flimsy. Some of them look like, you know, hazmat suits. But I think what's going to become increasingly interesting in terms of facial recognition, and of course the book came out before the pandemic hit, is how we will be recognized only by the top portion. So our mouths can no longer be seen, our jaw lines can't be seen, our bottoms of our ears cannot be seen. So to what degree those algorithms can do what they need to do, can face swap as they want to, can create what they need to do by only detecting the top half of the face, I'm not so sure.
Wouldn't it be sad in some ways if what we began doing in response to a public health pandemic morphed into a desperate search for privacy that we feel is being increasingly stripped by covering ourselves, by hiding ourselves in public.
It's true. And there are some artists who are trying to do, they're trying to circumvent and obviate and deviate and create things where the visual resonance of something as simple as your face is actually protected by jewelry or by a headdress or by a scarf. It remains to be seen, but in the meantime, we have to stay safe, and safe means wearing a mask, and certainly was not in the masks in my chapter. I wasn't looking at that. Perhaps I should have been, but the next issue of the book, perhaps.
Has it been a successful trip to LA? Are you hopeful of adapting this to something?
I am hopeful of adapting this to something, and you're very kind to ask. I think the stories that need to be told cannot only be told in a book. And I think there are many, many stories and many touching stories. We haven't talked about the chapter on othering, but there's a wonderful archive at Yale on the history of disability, children in wheelchairs, children who were exiled because of a facial disfigurement. And that still goes on all over the world. And that's something that we need to really think about hard and for a long time to come. I really think that I was glad that I got to think about that, and those stories should be told by people who are experiencing exile, experiencing stigma, and all faces are not equal, and they shouldn't be equal, and that's kind of part of the point. That's really a big part of the point, and so I think that those stories could be better told on film. And if we ever resume filming, I hope that somebody will be interested in doing it. I have made a little headway, but hope to make more.
Thank you so much, Jessica Helfand, co-founder of The Design Observer and a senior critic at the Yale School of Art. The book is Face, A Visual Odyssey. There is also a video for you to view on our webpage, a video trailer.